gavel isn't tangled. All right. Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order. Welcome, everybody. It's good to have you here. We are, as per normal, not going in order. We are going to start with Senate Bill 763 because we have the good senator here. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 763. Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 763 makes a general fund appropriation to the Oregon Health Authority for mental health programs. It declares an emergency and is effective July 1st, 2015. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Madam Chair, thank you very much for scheduling the hearing and for allowing me to come before this committee, as I am overdue for my Rules Committee, but I appreciate that courtesy. Ted Ferrioli, for the record, State Senator from District 30. Madam Chair and members of the committee, all of you know very, very well that there isn't a family in Oregon that's been here any length of time that hasn't had a personal experience with mental health issues. Depression, just failure to cope, post-traumatic stress disorders, just stress in general, and even more systemic mental health issues. All of our policies have been pointed for a number of sessions at parity, mental health parity. We all talk about that, and we encourage our agencies through the budgetary process. We've even mandated that parity in insurance mandates. But it still is a situation where with 137,000 adults among our 3.8 million residents having serious mental illness and 39,000 children in Oregon having those issues, we still aren't reaching everybody that needs these services. The bill before you, if you will notice, is very brief. It's only two sections, and basically it talks about an appropriation and an emergency clause, and if you'll notice, there is no amount included in the appropriation. The purpose of this bill is to start the discussion about doing a little bit more for funding mental health services, and it's intended to be something that this committee takes up and then refers to the Ways and Means folks to have the discussion about the issues that this bill intends to bring into focus, and that is, of course, that we have a suicide rate of 17.1 persons per 100,000, which is quite a bit higher than the national average. We have a system that provides mental health services to only 43% of the adults who have been identified as needing those services. We have a number of juveniles, youth in juvenile systems who are experiencing mental health disorders, and some even up to 20% in experiencing severe mental health disorders. And so the question is, will we essentially put our appropriations where our intentions are, and that is to provide more mental health services for the people in Oregon who need them? That's the sum total of what the bill does. It's meant, obviously, as an issue that catalyzes discussion. And it isn't, of course, up to this committee to fill in the blank, but it is up to this committee to forward this issue to those in Ways and Means who will be encouraged to fill in the blank. So thank you, Madam Chair, for the hearing.
Thank you. Senator, are there questions?
I would like to just make a comment. You know, we put a tremendous amount of money into mental health last session, and I truly believe in accountability and transparency of how that money is used. And so we have now a new governor, and we were hoping that maybe we could have a look at mental health like we did healthcare transformation. And so I'm hoping that along with money for mental health, that we really are going to look at evidence-based mental health services and expand in that route. So I just wanted to put that on your record because I share with you the need for mental health services in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I agree that catalyzing the discussion, setting priorities, and making sure all of Oregonians get a chance to weigh in on the issue, which I think speaks to the question of transparency. Those are exactly what we ought to be about here.
Well, and Senator Farrelly, building on both of these things, I'm very grateful that the Senate President has asked us to work on convening a conversation over the course of the next year about the state of mental health in the state of Oregon. We're going to have a lot of discussions about that today in a variety of different bills, but I think the best conversation that we can have that really pulls in information from all across the state is something that happens outside this building. It isn't something that we do on a task force. It isn't something that we do in a committee room. It's really getting out into the community and talking to individuals. I think one of the problems that we've had in our mental health system is that it's extremely fragmented. There are a lot of good ideas. There are a lot of good practices in different places. What works in your community might not work in mine. But the other problem is that we look at mental health as a problem when we look at it through a policy lens, rather than looking at people who live with mental illness as people that need support to learn how to live with mental illness in a really successful way. So my hope is that the conversation that we can have is about more than medications and placements, but it can also be about community support, family support, housing, workforce development, and really looking at that across the lifespan. And until we figure out how to put that together, I worry about putting in more money that isn't specified and maybe creating a system that's even more fragmented than the system we have now, rather than going out and talking to the people that are experiencing it every day, the clients, their families, and those practitioners that are on the front lines. Because if any of them come into this hearing room and listen to a presentation about how our system is supposed to work, they wouldn't recognize that system. And I just want to tell one story really quickly. I've described this as paper dolls, that when AMH comes to give a presentation that we want all of these different paper dolls, and I've talked about that in a variety of different community meetings. And someone came to a community meeting I had on Sunday and said, "Hey, I've got a paper doll for you." And this story was about a man who was married, and he was addicted and hit rock bottom, was feeling suicidal, had been for over a week, sometimes violent, asked his wife to take him to the emergency room to seek treatment. He got there, and he told them that he was suicidal. He was afraid he might hurt somebody else and himself, and he needed to be admitted and helped. But his blood alcohol level was above the legal limit, and so they said there was nothing they could do with him, and they sent him away. And as they got in the car, this family is terrified about what happens next for them. Here was the person that was seeking help. Here's a family with children that may be in danger. I followed up with AMH and with the hospital after that. It's not consistent with the way we think our programs work, or the hospital thinks the program works, or AMH thinks the way the program works, but that's the way people experience it. So we need to have that conversation to collect all these paper dolls from across the state to figure out where is it not working the way we describe, because that's where we start to get the stories of people falling through the cracks. So thanks for setting up the conversation for us today.
Well, and ma'am, thank you for that story. I'll share another. In much of rural Oregon, the mental health care facility is the county jail. You know, there simply aren't bed spaces. The distance between communities means that transporting people to available beds might be a regional question, not a local community answer. And so, you know, one of the things that we have to do as policymakers is, after we've decided this is a priority and after we've committed to looking at a more holistic approach to integration of our services, we really have to revisit the issue of, okay, what are we spending? How is it being prioritized? You know, what are the outcomes that we expect? I guess the purpose behind this bill asking for a direct appropriation is, a lot of what we do is judged by how much we invest. And so that's the question that I intended to ask here. If we're really prioritizing mental health more highly than we have in the past, you know, we do need to ask the questions about how we're spending and what we're prioritizing. But really, what is the level of our commitment? So that's the question that this bill is intended to focus on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 763? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 763 and open a, we're going to pop down to a work session section. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 222.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 222 was previously heard on March the 10th. The committee will recall it extends the sunset on the Department of Human Services authority to proceed as a party to certain juvenile cases without the Attorney General from 2015 to 2017. And there was an amendment pending at the time that had some constitutional issues. We got a memo from Legislative Counsel's office to that effect. So the parties got back together, Department of Justice, Judicial Department, and Department of Human Services. And the Dash 3 amendment has since been made available. That extends the sunset not to 2017 but to 2018 and permits a rollout, a staggered implementation of DHS appearances with counsel, naming certain counties in a certain progression through the extension of the sunset date. The Dash 3 has no revenue impact. A fiscal statement is just issued and was passed out here at the dais for everyone to take a look at, and we have a subsequent referral to a second policy committee, Judiciary, after this.
Right. And do we have someone that was going to come up and do any of the parties want to say something about this? You don't have to, but if anybody has anything they want on the record, this is the opportunity to do that. No, I just want to thank everyone for working so hard together, the Department of Human Services, the Department of Justice, the Oregon Judicial Department, and trying to find a path forward. I would like to put on the record that the goal of this amendment is that within 3 years there will be full representation. It's very important that we have full representation. This gives us a path to do that. If Ways and Means grants us funding, if Ways and Means does not grant the funding to go along with this bill, it's kind of a catch-22. There's about a $20 million fiscal on this. Is that correct for this biennium?
DOJ.
If the bill does not pass and come to the floor, then the sunset is lifted altogether, and DOJ and DHS will have to immediately provide full representation for all of the individuals. So we need to get it through Judiciary so they can wrestle with this issue down in Ways and Means. Questions? No. With that, Chair, Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 222, dated 3/19/2015.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 222, dated 3/19/2015. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Did you hear that?
Are you done smacking? Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 222 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Judiciary by prior reference.
Vice Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 222 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Judiciary by prior reference. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the motion passes, and the bill will go on to the Judiciary Committee.
Madam Chair?
Yes?
We should record that Senator Cruz is
not here.
Excused.
Okay.
Just for the record.
Thank you. Is he coming later?
I didn't get a message from him.
Okay.
He actually, I think you asked, is there any discussion? But you didn't ask.
And then I said, is there any objection?
Me too.
Yeah. Is there objection? Do you want to go back?
No,
but you should excuse Cruz.
Okay. Yes. So we will excuse Cruz for the record. There were no objections. The motion passes. The bill is going to Judiciary. And now I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 222. Moving on. All right. I am going to briefly open up a work session on Senate Bill 710. Colleagues, we had a public hearing on this bill last week. We are not ready to move this bill today. I know there are still more questions that are out there. We're trying to track down the number of cases that would be impacted. It's important to clarify for the record, this isn't about every application for Social Security disability benefits. This is only for those that are moving forward on an appeal and only for those records that are new to the file. But we do need to determine how many that is and what the impact is. I understand that Tracy Paul and Epic Piper might be here to offer some comments. Please join us. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Paul. I'm Vice President of DBS Health Information. We're a small business here in Oregon that works as business associates for health information departments in Oregon. We represent about 25 different healthcare facilities in Oregon, including OHSU. So we have been in business since 1986 here in Oregon, assisting these departments in releasing healthcare information. This particular bill, when you reviewed it last week, there were many questions from where are the voices of the people that are actually releasing this information. And I thought I would just give you a little bit of information about how that process works at the hospital and healthcare facility level. These requests that come in are not processed by volunteers at the hospital. They have to be processed by trained professionals. And the training process that goes into knowing how to release health information is very detailed. There are a host of federal and state laws that tell us what we can and can't release, how we can and cannot release that information. And so in order to actually release the information, it takes a paid personnel to do that. In addition to that paid personnel, I think the question that this bill is trying to answer is, who is the one that's responsible for incurring that cost of providing the health information? And at this point, it stands to reason that the healthcare facilities have some administrative costs in administering healthcare and continuing care for their patients. Lots of records go from one department to a different facility to help with continuing care of the patient. The hospitals and clinic associations provide free copies for to substantiate their billing, other review aspects to make sure that they're doing proper documentation. But when it comes to releasing health information to a third-party requester, for example, in this bill you have three different entities that can receive a free copy of the information. One is the individual. One is the individual's personal representative, which in healthcare we really look at those as one and the same. A personal representative is somebody who can make healthcare decisions on behalf of the patient, like a minor's parent. And then the third party that is authorized to receive a free copy in this bill would be the authorized representative of the individual. And that opens up the door to a whole host of requesters. It could be the individual's attorney. It could be Disability Determination Department, Social Security Administration. All of those entities currently pay for copies of health information because I think they all understand that they that there's a fee involved and that it's not the responsibility of the hospital to bear the burden of that cost of producing that health record. Especially, you know, I look at these attorneys that are representing the patient and helping them to get their benefits. Those attorneys are in the business of representing these individuals because they stand to gain financially from that information. And I think it's always been known in the healthcare community that if somebody stands to gain financially from the use of that health information, they're the ones that should have to pay the cost of retrieving that information. There's currently already in the OAR 847-012, Section 7 says that patients cannot be denied a copy of their health information for inability to pay. That's already a law that exists. I have yet in my 20 years of working in healthcare seen any healthcare facility draw a hard line of not of making a patient pay for health information if they can't afford it. They're readily offered copies of their information if they can't afford it. But this bill really is written for the attorneys, unfortunately, the legal entity that is trying to gain financially from helping these individuals receive disability benefits.
So if the language around the authorized representative was removed and it was the individual or the personal representative, would that relieve the concerns that
it would definitely you have? Relieve the concerns, and then it would bring up another concern. Why even have the bill if that's already
it's already written?
It's already an OAR.
And so, I think what I've heard from the proponents and the individuals involved in the bill is that they aren't able right now to always get these to get the records, and they're working under that very stringent timeline of that Social Security appeal. I think the attorneys heard that concern about whether or not attorneys might stand to profit, but still felt like even if that authorized representative was removed, it would still be worthwhile. One of the issues that was raised is that a very low-income individual that's working on a Social Security determination. Again, this is only on the appeals. It's not that initial application. It's only in that appeal that the attorney is not able under their code of ethics to finance that program. So they can't pay it up front, but these low-income disabled individuals also wouldn't have the money up front or the ability to go out to all these places to collect that information to be able to get it done. And that's a barrier that people are facing. And it's a little bizarre, having kind of supported some people with pretty significant disabilities going through Social Security determinations. Some disabilities that are denied that are pretty obvious are problematic, and those tend to be those that are in pretty significant need.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that it is definitely the wording of the individual's authorized representative, that it's not only just the attorneys that would be authorized, but that patient could authorize anybody to get a free copy, and that the doors are wide open on who those requesters are.
Senator Danbrough?
Yeah, just following up. I mean, I think that, you know, in this circumstance, presumably an attorney is acting, you know, in place of the individual. I mean, it's not, they're not going out shopping for information. It's just the individual presumably is not, maybe doesn't have the capacity to request the information directly, so the attorney is acting as their agent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yes, I mean, whether the attorney is paid on a, however the attorney is paid, that's just part of their compensation for acting as the representative. It's different than if, you know, you had another company, you know, a company that was for their own profit just seeking this information. So,
Chair Gessler and committee members, yes. I think the way that the bill is written doesn't make those.
Can you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you. My name is Epic Piper. I'm also with the same organization as Tracy Paul. I think the way the bill is written, I think we all understand the finer points of what the intention is, but as it's written, it's not written that this is only for appeals. That wording is not in the bill. And I would wonder if someone's, our company has always promoted itself as being a member of our community, and we would like to be proponents for the patient. I think it's hard for me to understand why the bill exists when we already have current laws that make it available. And I do understand that sometimes gathering your medical records is an experience for anyone who hasn't done it before. I would wonder if a person is really not able to begin the navigation of that process if they would be denied. Do you have any comment on that? Would someone who wouldn't be able to request their own records be denied, do you think?
So this is different. It's not typical for to ask questions of the committee. So,
especially when we don't know the answer.
What we're being told is that this is a problem that people are having. So okay. I believe the people that say that they're having this problem. There's not great profit to be made out there on this narrow, I understand the issue that your companies have of releasing the records and the work that goes into that, mm-hmm. but this little piece, this is not a huge moneymaker for trial attorneys. That's not, I have no belief that that's the motivation of this. I believe the motivation is to make sure that people are able to access the records to go mm-hmm. through that process. If the bill was clear that it's about appeals, would that also address your concerns? And I guess the next question is 20% of your business based on that single record for appeals mm-hmm. when benefits have been denied, or is that 20% requests that come from attorneys and third parties?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the 20% of requests that health care, it's depending upon the facility, some get more, some get less, but anywhere between 15 to 20% of the requests that come in for health information have to do with these appeals. You're looking at upwards of 40% of requests for disability information in general. So when looking at about 20% is for those appeals. In reference to the attorneys that might be helping the patients request their information, I believe that if if that language in there that the authorized representative also gets a free copy, I think you're going to see an exponential increase in the amount of requests that the disability attorneys are requesting, because they're going to request that information up front to decide if they're going to take the case on. And right now, they don't necessarily, there are a lot of requests that come in that are fulfilled, awaiting payment before the information is released, and a lot of the disability attorneys will just decide not to take on the case but the work's already been done because they requested the information. So I think that that's your biggest thing to overcome, is if you took out that authorized representative, it makes it a bill that's already being complied with. It's a law that we're already presenting the information to.
Any other questions for this?
Yeah, I have a question then. Looking at the bill, what is the specific difference between an authorized representative or a personal representative? Because if I tell Senator Dembro to go get my stuff, he is my personal representative.
Would
he also be authorized? Or?
Go ahead.
Chair Gessler and committee members, the definition of a personal representative is outlined in HIPAA, and a couple of bills that are actually involved in session right now, as well as high-tech information. So that personal representative has already been defined, someone who can make healthcare decisions on your behalf, and you have made that clear to your healthcare worker.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much for your time, Chair.
And I think Patty O also wanted to come up. Is that? You don't have to. I just got a note that said you might like to. We try to be accommodating here.
Thank you. Good afternoon. This is the first time I've appeared in front of the Human Services Committee, so I'm glad
ever?
To be here. Oh, no, not ever. I used to live here, actually. this year, sir. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I'm a lobbyist for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and we are neutral on the bill. I will tell you that we already do this for the patient or the person applying for Social Security. We normally do not give, some of our hospitals deal with third parties that do this work for us, and some do it themselves. We normally don't give a free copy to an attorney, but the bill will call for that. And it's just, it's going to be a fiscal impact, but something that we're willing to absorb, because if we don't give it free to the attorney, they'll just ask the client to go get it. And sometimes they aren't able to, work through the system and know what to ask for and push when they're told, that you have to pay money or something like that, because they're not sure what their rights are. So we're willing to do this. We already do it, and we believe it's important that they have their medical records to apply or appeal for Social Security benefits. If they're applying or appealing for their Social Security benefits, they normally don't have the money to pay for it themselves anyway. Just to let you know, though, sometimes the attorneys, if they win the case, are reimbursed. In one way, they don't really need this, but we don't want to have to keep track of everything, so we'll just give it to them for free. And I know the bill calls for either or, so one free copy, so it's when they apply for Social Security or when they appeal Social Security. And so that's enough record keeping for us on this one.
Okay,
so we're neutral on it. Yay, we don't want to spend more money, but, we're not opposed to this at all.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this panel? Anybody else that wants to offer some further information to Senate Bill 710? Seeing none, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 710. It will come back at another time. We have Senator Bates, only at 8:40, so I'm going to open up a... So I thought we were posting 8:40 just for the purpose of moving it to Senator Monica Anderson's committee. No, that was a different bill. That was the bill about health insurance. This one we were... Wasn't this the one that you did want your committee? That is kind of picking up the nurse practitioner? But we have it now, so we can start. Okay.
You get paid by the hour.
All right.
That's about 25 cents.
Wait, can we just go off the record for 1 second? Can we just pause for a quick second?
Am I on the wrong bill?
Just one second. Can we go? Okay, we're back on the record, and we are on Senate Bill 840. Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 840 expands authority and process to exercise custody over mentally ill persons to include licensed independent practitioners in addition to physicians. It defines licensed independent practitioners and declares emergency effective on passage.
Senator Bates.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Alan Bates, District 3 State Senator. And this is a pretty simple bill in some ways, and actually most ways. It's really about right person, right time, right place. And what this bill says in very simple terms is that if you have a situation in which to protect a patient, you're going to put a hold on them, then you have to have two people basically to do it. You want to do that in a way that is as quick and efficient and safeguards that patient. The problem is that quite often you haven't got that second person there at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night. As a practicing physician, and when I used to be chief of medicine at two different hospitals, I would often get a phone call at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning about a particular patient at the emergency room. I talked to the ER doctor about it, and we'd usually have a nurse practitioner or an advanced practice nurse there who really knew what was going on. And I talked to her usually, and we go ahead and put a hold on until we could get in the next day, and until the county officials came in and confirmed that, saying that a patient needed to be where they were and they're being kept safe. The way it reads now, and what you have to do now is I'd have to sign off on people I really hadn't seen until I get in the next morning, or if I was tied up. And it's just saying that people who are qualified to do this and who are making those decisions have a right to sign it off under the supervision of a physician. So it just makes the program really represent what's really going on and stop kidding ourselves about people signing off on things they're not really there to see. And I have a lot of experience with this. I have complete confidence that people who are really there, who have been certified by their facility to do this. This isn't just somebody off the street. They have to be certified through the hospital or a mental health facility to do this. So I just think it's a good bill. It'll clean up a problem that's been around for 20 years. And in the end, it's actually better for the patients. And that's the most important thing.
So, Senator Bates, we received a letter from Bob Jundiff of Disability Rights Oregon, who requested an amendment. Is Bob here somewhere? Don't see him. So basically it says Disability Rights Oregon has no objection to extending the authority to institute involuntary psychiatric holds and treatment to psychiatric nurse practitioners as well as physicians. But these treatments can include involuntary medication, application of medical restraint, seclusion, and transfer, very significant and intrusive practices. And then he goes on to say, if Senate Bill 840 can be interpreted to grant this authority to other medical professions, DRO is concerned that these powers could be wielded by professionals who are not certified, trained, or experienced in providing psychiatric care and treatment. So their recommendation was to narrow this to psychiatric nurse practitioner to make sure that to protect the rights of those individuals from inappropriate use of seclusion and restraint. And I share those concerns that he's raised.
I understand why they have those concerns, okay? I don't think you need to narrow it, though. The narrowing occurs with the certification done by the facility, and those are really tight certifications. Those are reviewed annually or semi-annually, and every 90 days make sure that the person doing is not doing something inappropriate from the point of view of background checks. I think the key here is, and I looked at it carefully too because I crossed my mind, who's going to be doing this?
Right.
And as long as we're being certified by the facility, I'm comfortable with it. I don't want to restrict that. There might be some places in rural Oregon or smaller places where you haven't got that kind of people there, but you do have trained people who can do it. I think that the best way to do it is allow that facility, which is going to make the decision about certification, to do it. And those facilities have to be licensed by and certified by the state themselves. So I feel pretty comfortable with that. Just narrowing it down, I'm concerned about what might happen in rural areas. And that's a big difference in Portland or Salem or Eugene or even places like Corvallis. We have places like out in Lakeview and others where they see these patients, and they may not have exactly the right person under a law, but they've certified that person, know that person can do it. This is about protection of those patients.
And I think DRO's concern is also about the protection of the rights of the patient. Could you kind of get with Bob and make sure that you both have a shared understanding of the narrowness of that?
To.
I think it'll be hard to move it forward without that thumbs up from DRO.
I'd be glad to.
Great. Thanks. Senator Olson.
I'm very naive in this area. Could you give me an idea of who would be a licensed independent practitioner?
You'd have to have somebody first who is who would be qualified by a certified facility to do this. So it would be people like advanced practice nurses, nurse practitioners, physicians. In some cases, you might use a PA, but probably wouldn't. You could even sometimes use a psychologist if that psychologist has been specially trained in these areas and it's been certified by the hospital to do this. Now, that person couldn't write prescriptions or do much other than saying this is appropriate to have this patient held here for 72 hours while we can find out what's going on and make sure they're safe. So those are the kind of people you're primarily talking about, people of that nature. And it varies from time to time and shift to shift. I mean, you could find, like I said, the 3 o'clock in the morning Saturday night thing is what I always think about because that's when I got called. And then we're running around trying to find another doctor, finding somebody who's capable of doing this, when actually the people we need are sitting right there in the emergency room with the patient and know what's going on.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Senator Bates?
No. Good.
Thank you very much.
I guess I've got a job to do yet.
Yes.
Thank you.
And I'm sure he will chat with you. Hopefully we can get that worked out quickly.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Okay.
Find the right list here. Okay. Next we have Robin Henderson, Paul Geiger, and Cindy Sherba. Welcome.
Thank you for having us on, Madam Chairman. And we're here to testify in support of Senate Bill 840. My name is Cindy Sherba. I am a registered nurse for 30 years practicing in Oregon. I spent most of my career at OHSU as the Clinical Director for Behavioral Health Services. I'm also here today as the Chairman for the Oregon Psychiatric Association, which is a subgroup of the Hospital Association Committee on Health Services. Partially, just a little bit of background for the subcommittee work that we're working on this year is really the focus, as you mentioned earlier in one of the sessions, is to look at the issues related to system-wide, statewide, related to inpatient ED boarding and our ED boarding and inpatient psychiatry boarding. There are 15 inpatient psych units that are located within the 60 hospitals within the system. So part of our work is to really look at, I think as Senator Bates said, what do you get the patient in the right time, in the right place, with the right quality of care and service. So Senate Bill 840 will incorporate the licensed independent practitioner language. And then there was some discussion earlier about who that might include. And so I wanted to just clarify a bit who that would include in the language in this bill. It's very clear in the definition to look at these are individuals, including physicians, who are licensed and certified in the state to provide medical care and services without direct supervision within the scope of the individual's license certification and consistent with the clinical privileges granted to the individuals by hospitals and non-hospitals. So it's very defined, and this is a national definition that CMS uses also as they look at the use of licensed independent practitioners. So that includes primarily nurse practitioners and physicians and physician's assistants. So I think one of the things to lead into this that's really exciting right now is that this is a time right now in mental health where we really have an opportunity to do something different. So as somebody who's been in mental health most of my career, I'm really excited to look at how we can design services differently. To design services differently, we need to look at our workforce. So we need to look at those individuals who were able to provide specialty mental health care to individuals and patients who are suffering from mental illness. So it's really important as we look at one of the major changes in ED boarding is really to look at right now patients enter a service and they get services from an emergency room physician, somebody who's not specialized in mental health. As we look at crisis stabilization and changing our clinical care model, we look at providing crisis mental health services for those folks who are in crisis. That will require folks an increase of our workforce, which looks at including the licensed independent the LIP language into the workforce. So the other piece is that we don't really have the ability right now to do the training. So as part of Oregon Health Science and the university and the School of Nursing, There's not very many sites to be able to train folks who have in nurse practitioners, psychiatric nurse practitioners, and other general nurse practitioners in acute care and mental health. So this will allow us opportunity to improve care for patients and also opportunity to expand the workforce and educate our future workforce here in Oregon.
Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Geiger. I'm the medical director, Providence Behavioral Health for Oregon. I've been with Providence about 11 years, mostly doing acute care, psychiatry, working in hospitals, and consulting on medical wards, seeing acutely ill patients. Providence is the largest private provider of psychiatric services in the state with numerous hospitals, programs, et cetera. I'm here to support this bill. We feel that this bill promotes teamwork. Our teams of clinicians are comprised of physicians, nurse practitioners, social workers, psychologists, et cetera, working together to get patients seen, provide good care. And currently, nurse practitioners are not able to do some of the activities outlined in this bill that creates barriers for calling doctors. And Senator Bates mentioned the phone call to kind of drag someone not directly involved in the case to be able to sign off on a form, kind of a technicality, when the licensed and trained person who knows the case well and is competent to make a judgment in that is kind of excluded from that. So we're supporting this as a way to extend our providers and provide more flexibility and able to provide care. And I think that that kind of summarizes the support for it.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Robin Henderson. I'm the Chief Behavioral Health Officer at St. Charles Health System in Bend, Oregon, and we're also in support of this bill. I'm a licensed psychologist by training, and while this bill doesn't necessarily impact me, I want to tell you a little story about something that happened earlier this year in Central Oregon and part of why this bill became important for us. Late last year and early this year, we lost more than half of our psychiatric staff in a matter of weeks, and ended up having only two psychiatrists to serve all of the patients that we serve. And as a reminder, we run the only psychiatric unit east of the Cascade Mountain Range, and the only acute psychiatric unit. And when we lost half of our staff, at that point, we had to enter into trying to find locums. We couldn't look for locums who were nurse practitioners because this type of bill allowing us to use nurse practitioners didn't exist at this point. Additionally, we couldn't utilize other types of providers as well because we didn't have the flexibility the bill provided. So for a period of nearly 2 months, we went down to 8 patients for a region that serves half of the rest of the state. And it was very difficult for us. That's what kind of got us really interested in supporting the bill. The other thing to know is that in our ER, we use family nurse practitioners in our ER, as many ERs do, and especially in rural Oregon. And in our ER, one of our best providers working with acute mental health is a family nurse practitioner. And every time he works with a patient, he has to go and get some doc who's never met the patient to co-sign off on that. And that's the kind of workaround and additional work in a busy ER that isn't very helpful and doesn't really serve the patient needs. So I agree with Cindy that this is a workforce development bill. This is an administrative simplification bill. The power to decide what someone can do within a hospital remains with the hospital's credentialing committee. So if hospitals don't want to do this, they don't have to. But when you're out in rural Oregon, sometimes you have what you have and you do the best you can. And having someone come in the next morning and sign your paperwork isn't great practice. So we think this aligns what we actually do with how we do it and makes it a whole lot cleaner for everybody. I appreciate Bob Jundeff's concerns, but I can tell you, like Cindy said, it's very difficult for us to get psychiatric nurse practitioners. Having them posted in my ER, which is where a lot of this stuff takes place, there just aren't enough of them. And out in Lake County, they're not going to have that. And if they are lucky enough to get a psychiatric nurse practitioner to go out there, they're certainly not going to put them in their hospital. They're going to want them to be somewhere where they can see a lot of patients, usually community mental health. So we really have to think about the talent of what we're using people for. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
No, I want to thank you. Workforce, mental health is new to this committee. This committee is new. So you have to educate this committee on what we have been doing in the past and trying to beef up the workforce in mental health in particular, and we so want to sort of redesign the delivery of mental health systems, and I think this is a bill that could really help. Thank you.
Well, and I hope that you too will follow up with Mr. Joondiff. I think the issue isn't necessarily that amendment, but we have to grow our workforce and also respect the rights of patients all in the same process. So I look forward to moving this when we get the thumbs up from the advocates. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Katie King.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katie King, and I'm here representing OSEP, the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. And OSEP supports Senate Bill 840, improve care for people in mental health crisis coming to emergency departments is a top priority for OSEP. Emergency department visits for psychiatric illness or addictions account for 6 to 9% of all visits. But what I hear from my physicians is sometimes they take up half of the beds. So allowing someone such as a mental health nurse to perform some of these two-person holds instead of limiting this function to physicians only will help reduce wait time for patients and also free up some of the beds for someone that might be coming in with a heart attack or a stroke. So in summary, OSEP believes that this is a good policy, and we hope to see this pass. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Katie?
I have one.
Awesome.
Yeah, thank you, ma'am. I'm looking at some documentation that all of us have received, and they're concerned about licensed certified independent practitioners. It says that it appears to include anyone licensed or certified in Oregon to provide medical care and services within the scope of that license or certification without supervision. So mm-hmm. they're concerned about an expansion of that. Would you have an answer to that?
Oh. Well, we
I
have
guess if you don't,
Patricia
somebody does.
Sullivan here.
Again, my name is
Patio. We just want you to be here all the time.
Very much, and I'd love to be. Again, for the record, my name's Patio Sullivan. I'm with the Association of Oregon Hospitals. A couple of things to clarify. Rather than just everywhere it said physician, adding and nurse practitioner, we found a definition, a federal CMS definition of LIP, licensed independent practitioner. They have to be independent practitioners. Even PAs are not covered by this bill because they have to be overseen by a doctor. They're not an independent practitioner. So really the LIP, while it's a new term to everybody, we're hoping that it becomes a common term as we expand our workforce because it only includes doctors, which psychiatrists are doctors, and nurse practitioners. We were at one point we're going to put in psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners, but there's really no such thing in a license. So we left that out. The hospitals are not required to allow this. If you are privileged to work in the acute care unit and your privilege includes doing this, then you can do it. A hospital does not have to allow it if they don't want to. And it can only be a nurse practitioner or a physician. And so that I want to make that real clear. It's not all these other people. It's just these two people. Nurse practitioners do the majority of the real work, casework, workup, and working with the patients. And they do this anyway. And like Senator Bates said, they have to run down to the ED to get another signature. We had a group that put this and another bill together, which hopefully you'll get come over from the House, on mental health to help us in our part of the mental health system. Everyone talks about the community system and services and the Oregon State Hospital, but they never talk about the ED And the acute care units where we have the very sickest people come to us, and we need to stabilize them and then move them on to get a long-term treatment. But we can't move them on if they're sitting there from Friday to Monday waiting for a signature. We need to move them on to where they can get some long-term psychiatric care or go back home or go back to the community. So our two bills are trying to attempt to streamline that system so that we don't have people sitting in our emergency room for up to 14 days in an emergency room bed. So that's the purpose. This is the easier of the two bills. We did have a small group, which included Ms. King, Cindy Sherba, Robin Henderson. It included a representative from NAMI who worked through this with us, and Sharon Myron, who's an ED doc in Kaiser at Kaiser Hospital, and they do not have an acute care unit. So I wanted a representative of a hospital that has to ship all their people. Mm-hmm. So it's a small group. We're here to support this bill, and if you have any other questions, I'd be glad to answer them, and I will talk to Mr. Junedep. I actually did have a conversation with him, and he didn't think he had any problems, but I guess he did, and he didn't come back to share them with me. But
well, thank you, and I appreciate that, and it may very well be that you're description and definition of that practitioner will resolve the issue. So hopefully we can.
We probably would have solved this just by not being unique and putting LIP, but just putting a nurse practitioner everywhere that it was a doctor. But there are some places where we left just physician because there's some activities that just a physician should be doing.
Can you give an example of what?
I don't have the bill in front of me, and I honestly can't remember.
Okay. Very good.
I do have a follow-up.
Okay. Oh, compelling medication orders.
Okay.
And some of the things that Bob was concerned about.
I think those clarifications are really important. Senator Olson?
Yeah, I do have a follow-up on that. The outlying hospitals, apparently the metro areas are pretty well taken care of with people that work there. The mm-hmm. outlying hospitals, would they have these licensed independent practitioners?
Chair Gelser, Senator Olson, you know, we have problems in our rural areas with retention and getting certain types of healthcare workers. And to get a psychiatrist, Ms. Henderson explained, Bend had to shut their unit down because they didn't have enough psychiatrists. So you have to search far and wide to get them, or what typically happens is you steal them from somewhere else. So they just move around the state. And it would be the same with nurse practitioners that were credentialed, privileged, and trained in psychiatric mental health services, yes. It's hard, but that's one of the reasons to open this up so that we can use more people, train more people on the ground, and get more help out in our hospitals.
I guess the answer you gave me was no, you don't have enough people out in the outlying areas.
There is never enough.
So then what would happen if a person came in and there wasn't two people to generate this ability to hold them? What happens then?
Chair Gelser and Senator Olson, you have to remember not all of our hospitals, and typically the very small hospitals, do not have psychiatric units. So they get them in their emergency room, and they try to get them as stable as possible and ship them to one of the acute care units. So if you're looking at a Baker City or a Pendleton, they have to take them to St. Charles. And if St. Charles doesn't have a bed, they take them to Medford. And if Medford doesn't have a bed, they take them to Portland. Yeah. These people that are having an acute psychotic break are really very, very sick, and there's really beds are filled every Friday and Saturday night in Portland, so they ship everybody to Corvallis and is a typical place, maybe Coos Bay, maybe Medford. So they're kind of shipped all over the state. This isn't really a regional or county system. The acute care system for psychiatric folks is really a state system. And then they sometimes wait months for a bed in the state hospital, so which is a different story than this bill. This bill is trying to solve one problem. I'll be back with a bill that solves other problems.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Is there anybody else that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 840? So our hope is to be able to move this. It sounds like a brief conversation will probably be able to resolve the issues, so we look forward to bringing this back sometime. Well, I guess we'll bring it back sometime in the next few weeks, won't we? And with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 840 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 834. Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 834. Creates a task force on effective mental health treatment staffed by the Oregon Health Authority. It specifies the composition and object. It requires a report to the legislature by September 15, 2016. And sunsets December 31st, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And there was a similar bill, I believe, on the docket with some similar language.
And I don't have anybody signed up for Senate Bill 834. Is there anybody that would like to be heard on Senate Bill 834?
Madam Chair, Senate Bills 787 and 834 were very similar, and so Bates and I had come up with the 787, he had come up with the 834, and so we'll hopefully I can speak to 787.
Okay, yeah. Sounds good. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 834 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 787. Cheyenne.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 787, again, very similar language, but the bills are slightly different in their details. This one also creates a task force on mental health care and treatment staffed by the Oregon Health Authority. It specifies the composition and the object of the task force and requires a report to the legislature by September 15th and sunsets December 31st, both of those in 2016. Also declares emergency effective on passage and has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Welcome, Senator Montesanderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montesanderson. I represent Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and a little bit of East Portland. When I wanted to have transformation in mental health, I felt that the way our mental health system is set up now, it doesn't work. And I was wondering, I know are people out there that know how to work the system better. I've heard of various entities like Legacy and OHSU going to set up a hospital just for mental health crisis in Portland. And I think Bend would love to latch on to an idea like that. We need to maybe have some innovative pilot projects. And I didn't know how to go about it. And then I started talking with Senator Bates. He wanted to do something, too, with mental health and being a little more creative than just throwing money at the counties. And we're not sure that it's really the money's is really reaching the people that it really needs to. And so then I heard that the former governor, was also working on a mental health plan. And so there were all these different factions that were working on mental health. And so I had drafted a bill, and then Bates says, hey, that's the same thing I want to do. And then Steiner Hayward came in and said she definitely wanted to have it. So this is just a start. It would be nice to send this bill down to Ways and Means, because we don't know exactly what we want to do with mental health. The timing might not be right, because we have a new committee now, and with you putting all the effort and energy into mental health, I'm not sure this is the bill that the way it's created is maybe the right way. But changes could be made depending on what the decisions are made with our new governor and what she wants to do with mental health. But we do need to relook at the system, and that's the intent of this bill, to relook at the system and hopefully bring a lot of people to the table to start figuring out how we can, yes, we want to put more money into mental health, but we've got to do it in a very effective manner. So that's the intent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next we have Stacy Michelson, Elizabeth Remley. I'll bring you up in two panels of two. Oh, never mind. And they just didn't get on the list. And how about Silas Halloran Steiner?
They want to go with two.
Work together on the show, Ramirez.
Oh, okay.
Can we testify?
Of course.
Exciting. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacey Michelson with the Association of Oregon Counties. Thank you for a little bit of time to testify this afternoon. I'm here, I want to let you know that AOC took a position in support of 787 with amendments, very minor issues around ensuring that local county government was represented on the task force, as well as our community mental health program partners. As I'm sure you're all aware, our county boards of commissioners serve as the local mental health authorities in their communities and is a role they take very seriously. I recognize we're having a conversation about where the appropriate place to discuss mental health is. Is it a task force? Is it something else? I want to make very clear that whether it's a task force or other forum, we're very supportive of having the conversation around our mental health system and very much want to be at the table for that. Just for a little bit of context, we see this as somewhat similar to the conversation that took place around public health over the last year, the task force of which Senator Montes Anderson was a member. We have felt really positively about that process, feel like it elevated some really great issues, and see the need for similar discussion around mental health, namely issues of, you know, statewide services that need to be available as a baseline that all Oregonians can expect to receive regardless of where they live. Also elevating some of the innovation that's taking place in some of our local counties and communities, and recognizing a need for where there's improved, where there is a need for improved resources, rather, at both the local and statewide level. And so I think having a similar conversation in the mental health field is very much needed. I'm sure in various committees you've heard some great examples this session of some of the great work that our counties are doing. Marion County's got a fabulous mobile crisis team that has significantly reduced the number of folks they're sending to the state hospital. Lane County has developed some sobering stations that are seeing great success. We've actually got some really great acute care facilities over in Eastern Oregon that are receiving folks from across the state. But obviously, there are some challenges in many of our communities, and some of our counties are really struggling with resources and how they allocate those. And we've seen those conversations emerge in recent years in Klamath County and Douglas County. And so I think having that broader conversation is really pivotal, and it's very important that we have those local voices at the table, both our county commissioners, who are the ones deciding those budgets at the local level, as well as our community mental health program directors, who are the ones providing services at the county level. And so I just want to state on the record that we're supportive of having the conversation. You know, if there's a way we can provide services better, I would echo Senator Ferrioli's comments earlier. You know, we do see a very high number of folks with mental illness and with addictions issues coming into our jails. We would rather serve them in a different location. So if there's a way that we can, you know, better serve folks in our local communities, we want to get there as much as you do, and want to help you have those conversations at the local level as much as we can.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of COPACT, which stands for the Coalition of our Oregon Professional Counselors and Therapists, Associations of Professional Counselors and Therapists, essentially these associations representing the licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists in the state. They're master's level professionals serving mental health and behavioral health patients across the state. We're really supportive of having any kind of conversation that we can have around mental health in Oregon. We know that the problem exists of access, and it exists of making sure that we're providing those services in the right forums. And one of the things that we noticed about Senate Bill 787 is that it doesn't include some of the master's level providers. I know that we stand with the social workers in asking that master's level providers be added to the task force. I'm not here to speak for the social workers, but I know they've had conversations with the bill sponsors. And I would echo that for the LPCs and LMFTs in the state. I'm not interested in adding a ton of people to the task force. We know that can get unruly when it turns into a crowd. So we want to be judicious about how we represent master's level providers on the task force. LPCs and LMFTs face a lot of barriers to serving their patients. A lot of times they're not able to take insurance because of the way that credentialing is done with health insurance companies, the way that panels are formed, and so they have a real interest in increasing access by making sure that network adequacy exists for insurance companies, and that's one of the things that we would encourage that any task force or conversation around mental health looks at is access through making sure that insurance coverage will actually cover the correct mental health services. So that's all I had today. Thanks.
Thank you. And I think The issue that you raised, and I've heard from some of the county mental health directors about the task force as well, goes back to some of the comments that Senator Monta Sanderson
yes.
made. There is a huge commitment and interest in a conversation about mental health. And one of the challenges that we have, if we go down the path of a task force, do we end up spending our energy figuring out who's represented at the table and who the person is sitting in the spot? And does that take away from the ability to create something outside of statute that might be a little bit more nimble, that actually allows us to involve more people and travel around and be a little bit more broad in our scope? The challenge there is, how do we resource that? And I've started participating in some conversations about how we might be able to resource something that demonstrates the same commitment as a task force, but maybe has a little bit more flexibility and reach. But I just think this is so important, because we have to have this conversation, and something has to change.
And you know that the relating to clause is very broad, relating to mental health.
Chair Gelser, if I may, there is a conversation going on at the insurance division around the mental health parity and making sure that mental health parity is actually being achieved in our healthcare system. And I would encourage Senator Monta Sanderson and others to loop in the insurance division on the mental health parity side of that provision of services. So.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Olson.
There's one bill that should be passed in this building, and that's acronyms.
That's right. You are new to this.
That's right. Yeah. LPC?
The Licensed Professional Counselors and Licensed Marriage and Family Therapists.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much.
If you were here a few sessions ago, we had two sessions in a row of licensed marriage and family therapists, and they, as a group, wrote the nicest thank you notes, encouraging notes during the day. It was always really nice to be visited by the marriage and family therapists. So thank you all very much. Next up, we have Chris Beneff and Caleb Hayes. And I am going to ask us to pick up our pace a little bit, because we have a couple more bills that are kind of complicated. So thank you. Chris.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm here representing the Oregon State Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. For those unfamiliar with NAMI, we're a grassroots organization, membership organization, primarily composed of individuals and families directly affected by mental illness. I can't necessarily speak to the wisdom of a task force per se, but it certainly is time that the state embark on a broader conversation, not only about the mental health system, but the integration of that, and that any group be empowered to really talk about the fundamental structural flaws that we have in our current public payer system. I mean, it's certainly, I appreciate Senator Monta Sanderson's comment, do you throw more money at it? We have peaks and valleys in the state. There are certainly some peaks that have come about because of the new investments that the legislature made. But it doesn't get us advance us far enough, and so it is with all the health transformation on. We certainly appreciate the opportunity for the conversation. I do appreciate the chair's comments too, to involve folks of those of us who have endured the system and still daily navigate the system, both as people receiving the treatment and support services that help us obtain and maintain our recovery, and as the support systems and family members who may support that individual through that journey. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Caleb.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Caleb Hayes. I'm here on behalf of the National Association of Social Workers Oregon Chapter. The National Association of Social Workers is the largest and most well-recognized professional association for social workers in the world, representing approximately 1,700 social workers right here in Oregon. I'm going to keep it brief, short, and simple. We appreciate the sentiments expressed by Senate Bill 787, and we support the bill. We do believe there needs to be a broader conversation, and we do stand with the therapists and the counselors in supporting master's-level providers being on whatever task force, work group, you know, whatever takes a look, whatever group takes a larger look at this conversation, our mental health system. And we also like to see a social worker involved in that conversation. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you both. And then Silas and Cheryl, please. And is there anybody else that's going to want to be heard on this that didn't get a chance to sign up? Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Gelzer, members of the committee. I'm here on behalf of the 32 community mental health programs across Oregon, and I'd like to support on their behalf the concept of developing improvements in the community mental health system. We'd also like to offer our assistance in a comprehensive mapping and analysis of gaps across the state, which was introduced by Lynn Saxton at the Ways and Means Human Services Sub last week. I just have three quick points that I'll condense from my written testimony. First, we embrace the vision for a good and modern mental health and addiction system, which is described as grounded in a public health model that addresses the determinants of health, system and service coordination, health promotion, prevention, screening, and early intervention, treatment, resilience, and recovery support to promote social integration and optimal health and productivity. This system should be designed and implemented using a set of principles that emphasizes behavioral health as an essential part of overall health in which prevention works, treatment is effective, and people recover. So building on this vision, we strongly encourage you to incorporate the guiding principles that we outlined in our written testimony. I'll just mention a few here. One is enhancing cross-system jurisdictional alignment and partnership, for example, public safety mental health partnership. Data needs to be central to any system reform. And priority outcomes should focus on health, illness prevention, and decreasing inappropriate use of institutional care. And then we need to include treatment services, non-direct service functions, and safety net services in our analysis. My second point is that a plan to modernize the community mental health system must be aligned with the USDOJ agreement with Oregon to resolve the Olmstead investigation. Some specific expectations that were recently outlined by the USDOJ include more assertive community treatment programs and other appropriate high-intensity services, continued increased investments in integrated community-based supported housing for individuals with serious mental illness, supported employment and crisis services. And then my third point is, in order to really improve the community mental health system, we need to move away from a fee-for-service model of payment to a multi-payer agreement to pay for value or health outcomes rather than encounters. If we continue with fee-for-service, we will not sustain the integrated care model that we're trying to implement in Oregon. So some examples of services and programs that do not fit in this medical fee-for-service model of payment.
And since we're running short on time, and this is on the task force bill, is it in the written testimony?
It is.
Great.
And I was going to end there. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to hand it over to my colleague and president of our association.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelsner, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Silas Halloran-Steiner. I'm the Health and Human Services Director in Yamhill County and the president of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And testimony today is on behalf of AOCMHB. I wanted to touch on three things that my colleague mentioned. One is the need for data, and we do support and want to be willingly involved in this system improvement. We think data is really integral. It's been the bane of our community mental health's existence, and we need to do better with that as a state. We have some ideas about a contractor who's a national consultant named Dale Jarvis, who's actually done some really interesting work in California and Washington State, and I think it'd be worth our time to look into the studies that he's been doing on behalf of statewide system improvement there, specifically looking at population health and prevalence as a way to get at gap analysis between the way that the funding of the services is today across a bunch of populations, which leads me to the second point, which is really thinking across multi-payer systems so that we're looking beyond just the public system if we're really talking about system and healthcare integration efforts and outcomes that we need for an entire community or an entire state of Oregon. So those payers are the commercial payers, the Medicaid, which is our Oregon health plan, the Medicare areas, and state general fund for safety net services. If we can look at those four areas as part of the analysis, I think that's really critical. We have inequities today that many folks are speaking to. Specifically, there are a lot of commercial inadequacies around network adequacy that drive populations to more sick care model because they're not gaining access. We have public systems of care that, as people deteriorate and get more ill, end up supporting the commercial payer system that isn't paying for that care, and it doesn't give the individuals that we want to serve the meaningful activities and lives that they deserve. The last point is really to be inclusive. Whatever this system design and redesign and analysis looks like, that it really is across behavioral health, and we don't forget about addictions. And in addition to the members' lives and stories and experiences that we're going to look at, that we look at, how do we pull a fragmented system together, hopefully through a fragmented, non-fragmented task force process. So if we can get this conversation to happen in one location, we really support that effort so that it isn't happening through one individual bill and another individual bill there. And we do great work every legislative session, and we're appreciative of that support. But I think the idea is the time is now, and there are a lot of folks who are interested in this work. So we'd like to align that, and we're passionate about doing that statewide and want to help. So thanks for your time.
Thank you both very much. Quick questions for this panel? No, thank you so much for the good suggestions. And no one else said that they wanted to sign up for Senate Bill 787, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 787 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 831.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 831 requires clinical mental health professionals provide mental health care and treatment to members of coordinated care organizations.
Great. And can we pull up a fourth chair? We've got four people, so we could do a four panel. Did you want to go up?
No, okay. I think in interest of time, let's just let the...
Carolyn Ellis, Chris, I always say your name wrong. Banaf, Katie King, and Robin Henderson. But they're different bills, so I want to do it separately.
Okay, I'll back clean up.
And you can go ahead and start. I want to make sure we get through both. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carolyn Ellis, and I'm a psychology resident and a behavioral health consultant with Providence, and this is my very first time testifying at any committee hearing ever. So
welcome to the Oregon Capitol.
Thank you very
much.
You come
back
often.
I really
appreciate it. So, and just to echo Senator Olson, if you were to ever introduce a bill that would ban acronyms, having been born and raised of the VA healthcare system, I would support you fully on that.
All right.
So I'm going to honor your request for speed and squish my testimony together, which is a highly technical clinical term right there. But so the benefits of integrated care, including the provision of comprehensive mental health services, is well known to Oregon. It's why we're one of the foremost pioneers of integrating care through CCOs. The integration of mental health into CCOs has a myriad of benefits, increased access, prevention, et cetera. But most importantly, it fulfills our promise to Oregonians to provide comprehensive and holistic health care. Sadly, we're not meeting those needs yet. People who present to primary care for services are still facing wait times, the referral process, and reduced access to care, even in CCOs that actually employ mental health professionals. The reason that these needs are not being met is actually twofold. First, in the general employment of mental health professionals in CCOs, and second is the ability of CCOs to actually use the mental health professionals that they employ. So both Senate Bill 831 and 832 actually lay the foundation for beginning to solve these issues. Despite widespread knowledge of the prevalence of mental health concerns in primary care settings, many CCOs still do not employ clinical mental health professionals in primary care. Senate Bill 831 would pave the way for CCOs to actually hire or contract with mental health professionals in their primary care settings. And just like physical health providers, this would allow any willing clinical mental health provider who's credentialed with the CCO to actually provide services. Also, because this is near and dear to my heart and I am acutely sensitive to having graduated last year, it also provides training opportunities for those of us who are interested in integrated care to actually train and develop our skills in these settings and become more competent clinicians. So that would be really helpful. It serves Oregonians by increasing their access to mental health professionals in their established care settings. To follow that, the foundation for CCOs to use mental health professionals is really supported by Senate Bill 832, which I know you guys will get to, but that provides that comprehensive definition and allows us actually to bill and provide those comprehensive services, so that is equally as important to us. I think the combination of these two bills actually serves Oregonians by allowing their providers to practice comprehensively and actually providing for providers in those settings. So I think that this is something that really does support our community and the people who live here. And as a professional community, we ask for your support.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonaf with NAMI Oregon. I'm going to, in reference to particularly Senate Bill 831, I'm going to paint with a broad brush, which is always a dangerous thing because it ignores some good things that are going on. But nevertheless, it's necessary in describing our position on that legislation. Is by and large, in all our health transformation and our CCOs and all this, we still face an age-old problem, which is access. And in particular, we added to the Medicaid rolls, and we didn't add really to our provider panels. And so you have willing providers out there who are willing to see us as OHP clients, but they cannot. Under an old system, there was an arcane way to go about it. We haven't completely updated that system, and we see, in particular, Senate Bill 831 as a solution to that, to allow people who are licensed to practice in other payer markets to actually practice within the OHP market, primarily to give us more access to licensed professionals, to give us greater provider choice, and to hopefully work on many of the access issues that we are enduring, which is longer wait times as panels have remained the same while the Medicaid rolls have increased. And just briefly, to use an example, I'm fortunate that I get to spend a lot of time on the Oregon coast and have spent a lot of time growing up there in my summers. So it was just recently in a conversation with one of the federally qualified health clinics that serves northern Tillamook County, based in Wheeler. And while they have the mental health staff there, they are fortunate to have a psychiatric nurse practitioner on staff at the clinic, which is a rarity. They do not get reimbursed to see OHP clients because, again, of the whole process by which a licensed practitioner has been traditionally kept off of provider panels for OHP patients. And so we see legislation like this helping to improve that pathway so that providers become credentialed more quickly with CCOs and are able to serve patients. So in this instance, patients don't have to drive 25 miles one way to see an approved provider within their CCO network. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Katie King, and I'm here today on behalf of the Children's Health Alliance. The Children's Health Alliance is an association of over 100 pediatricians across 5 counties in the Portland, Vancouver, and Salem metropolitan areas. The Children's Health Alliance supports Senate Bill 831 and 832. Integrating behavioral health into primary care practices is a priority for the Children's Health Alliance, and this bill will help support their work. So thank you for the opportunity to weigh in on both those bills.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Robin Henderson. I'm the Chief Behavioral Health Officer and Vice President of Strategic Integration at St. Charles Health System. I'm also the chair of CCO Oregon, who has been the heart of the work group that helped to develop the bill that's before you today. And while CCO Oregon does not support or endorse legislation, I bring that up because I wanted you to know that there was a broad array of folks from around the state who participated in the development of the concept for 831 and 832. What this sets, the two bills kind of travel together, and it sets the stage.
Would you want to open up?
Yeah, that's what I'm just thinking. I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 832.
Yes. Fabulous.
Well, great.
Let's just do them both at once.
Update us on Senate Bill 832.
Members of the committee, Senate Bill 832 requires Oregon Health Authority set standards for coordinated care organizations to integrate delivery of mental health services with physical health services. Directs OHA provide grants until June 30, 2017 to CCOs meeting those standards. Appropriates $1 million general fund to OHA to that end. Defines integrated behavioral health care. Adds data on the use of primary care homes offering integrated services to existing required quality measures. Requires CCOs to qualify mental health providers to offer qualified mental health providers to members, bars CCOs from restricting member access to mental health services, requires integrated services at one location, permits use of appropriate billing codes by mental health providers at integrated locations, declares emergency effective on passage.
Thank you.
Please
Thank
proceed. You. I'll proceed. So For the record, and I'll come back a little around at the end of the other panel to do a little bit of cleanup in here, there are some things that need to be cleaned up in both bills, and so I will be asking for an amendment to fix that. I didn't get the social work language right. I need to reference clinical social work associates, and I also need to reference a little bit different around internships in 831, and then I need to do some changes around in 832 at the request of some of the different partners who have started to see the bill. But I do appreciate hearing and talking about this issue. I've been working at St. Charles Health System to integrate behavioral health into primary care since 2009. We were an early adopter of these concepts because we believed that really it's all about health. It's not about mental health and physical health. It's about health. And we believe there should be no wrong door for care. And I think it was, it was Senator Bates who said, care needs to be provided at the right time, at the right place, with the right person. And a lot of times when folks show up for mental health care, they show up at primary care. And it creates a very different system when you look at somebody and say, oh, I see that you're here and you've got depression and we would really like to take care of that. Here's your pills and then here's your referral. And here's what we know. People only follow through on that referral 10% of the time. And yet 70% of the mental health care that's provided is provided in primary care. So when we started putting mental health providers into primary care, St. Charles doesn't get paid to do that. It was not a way that there was not a way to make this sustainable. And this bill isn't something to look to go and raid the specialty mental health budget. This bill is to provide us a way to accurately account for the work that we're doing, to be able to use mental health codes. Whether the CCO chooses to have those dollars come from specialty mental health or from physical health is really a CCO-level decision. It's about being able to use the codes and not having a system that says, you can use these codes, but you can't. The other issue comes to what Chris talked about, which is the type of language around licensed providers. We have a large licensed provider community that serves mental health in many communities in Oregon who can no longer serve Medicaid because most of that has to go through community mental health. We need to make a system that allows willing providers who are able to see mental health patients like LCSWs, LPCs, and psychologists and their trainees, have them have the ability to do so and be directly credentialed with the CCO. Part of the issue CCOs run into is that the qualified mental health professional, QMHPs, are not licensed, primarily not licensed providers, which means you need to credential the agency. And that's great and it's fine. But community mental health only sees about 5% of the problem. We have a lot of people who are not going served, especially in the expansion population, and they show up in primary care. And I've got a few folks here to tell you their stories about what that looks like on the other panels.
Thank you. And Chris or Katie, do you have anything to add since we opened up the other, knowing we have to adjourn at 1:45 today, so we're down to about 12 minutes.
No, I don't.
No.
All right. Thank you all very much. Next, we have Juliet Koltz and Denora Lopez.
Hello, Senator Gelser and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to provide my testimony today. My name is Juliet Kutz, and I'm a behavioral health consultant at Salud Medical Center in Woodburn, Oregon, which is part of the network of clinics that make up the Yakima Valley Farm Workers Clinic. I've been with Salud since 2012, and I am a licensed psychologist by training. I had something prepared, but actually, Senator Gelser, your opening comments in the early part of this kind of reformulated. You described our mental health system as fragmented, and I will tell you that's why I came to primary care, because it is fragmented, and the people who need to negotiate the system are oftentimes bound by their symptoms from being able to access the care they need. By working in primary care, part of my job is coordinating those pieces, making sure that I'm helping to connect the patients that I see with the services that they need. The other piece that you mentioned is that people are seen as problems. People who have mental health issues are seen as problems. And I would add to that, not only are they seen as problems, but they have to have a bad enough problem before they can get help. In primary care,
I don't have that limitation. I can see the person the day after they have a motor vehicle accident, before they start to have the symptoms of acute stress, before they meet the criteria for a diagnosis, and I can give them skills, and I can tell them what to expect. And I find that oftentimes patients don't develop those symptoms because they're not scared or shocked by them, because they're like, oh yeah, I talked to that lady. She told me this is what would happen. The other reason why I work at Salute in particular and out in Woodburn where it's more isolated is because there's a lot of barriers in the rural areas to care. I know if you have a car and a driver's license, Woodburn's not that far from Portland or Salem. But if you don't have those things, it's a really, really long distance. I work with patients who oftentimes do seasonal work. So they're working 12-hour days during certain seasons. They can't come in every week for an hour. And so I'm able to provide them what they need in the time that they can give me. I may see a patient once and then not see them for 6 months. And then they come back and they say, oh, I did your breathing technique, but I'm still having trouble sleeping. And I say, okay, let's talk about what's happening. And we develop a plan for them based on what they need in that moment. Sometimes that can help because the true issue maybe is a very deep trauma. But even thinking about talking to a therapist, even the idea of talking to a therapist feels overwhelming because they get flooded with those scary memories or with the symptoms that are causing them to come to primary care in the first place. So what I oftentimes do is serve as an interim level, so a level above outpatient mental health. I provide them with techniques and skills to help them manage those overwhelming sensations that they're having so that they can approach a therapist and tolerate the difficulty that can come with doing more intensive therapy. And I also get to work with the primary care physician, so we get to sit down together oftentimes with the patient and talk about how their mind and their body fit together. So that's a thumbnail of why I do what I do, but I'm actually going to turn it over to someone who can, I think, speak more efficiently about why I do what I do.
Thank you very much.
My name is Denora Lopez. I'm a patient at Salud Medical Center. I've been also a patient of Juliet's for months now. When I first went in, it was a very difficult time for me. I felt very overwhelmed with a lot of things. I was going through depression. A lot of things were going through my head, and my doctor told me, you know, Juliet's here. Do you want to talk to her? And I said, yes, bring her in. I needed something. I knew I needed to fix my behavior the way I felt about things. And when I talked to her, I felt a lot better. She worked with me, not against me, to help me improve how I felt. And I told her, honestly, that if they had just given me a separate appointment or, like, you know, let's make an appointment to talk to her or to refer me somewhere else, I would have talked myself out of it. I would have felt differently and tried to make me feel like I didn't need to go, like I was fine. And I knew that wasn't the case. I knew I needed help. And it's helped me so much that she's been there. You know, with the technique she's given me, I've had insomnia, I've overstressed, I've had depression, and I feel so much better now. I can't even express how much it's helped me knowing that she's there in the same city that I'm in and not have to go somewhere else and look for the help. And I just wanted to thank her for that as well.
Well, thank you so much for coming to tell your story. I think the point that you make about having that service right there and not needing to take that next step is so important. When you recognize you need that support and help, having it there at that minute is so important. So you've really described it well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to keep us moving along just so we can get to everybody. Our last panel, thank you both, is Linnea Lindsay Pingelli, Kristen Powers, and Silas Halloran-Steiner. We'll get the last word. And we unfortunately have about 6 minutes left. 2 minutes.
Chair Gelser and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Linnea Lindsay Pingelli. I'm the Medical Services Director for Trillium CCO, and I'm privileged every day to go to work and care for the folks who of our county, Lane County, where 96,000 people are members of the Oregon Health Plan in our county. It is a quarter of our county. We have the same problem that other counties have had. Our service area, we have now quadrupled the number of members in the last 3 years that we are serving.
I've had a great opportunity to work in the area of brains and bodies. I am a primary care psychologist. I came to the CCO just this last spring to be able to work on an integration project. We have an integrated care program that we have over 15,000 of our members being served in integrated services. These cover our hospital facilities, private practice, different medical groups. We have representation in our pilot projects of almost everybody within the county that serves our patients. We've been able to bring in independent practitioners. We've opened the codes. We've been able to bill both behavioral physical health codes and mental health codes within primary care and within our behavioral health medical homes. We've brought in independent practitioners who are licensed, and we have seen great hope happen. I want to tell you one story about a 9-year-old who was seen in our pediatric integration project. She had been being seen for bowel and stomach problems for several years. Her pediatrician had worked her up every way to Sunday and not been able to address the issue. There is a care coordinator who is working in that team-based care. She was able to gain the trust of the child. The child disclosed sexual abuse by her mother's boyfriend. They were able to quickly move the child into services because there is a pediatric psychologist on site. They were able to collaborate the care between the pediatrician, the pediatric psychologist, the care coordinator, able to get to DHS and legal services. This child is in recovery. We know so much about adverse childhood events, epigenetics, and the sequela of disease that happens when we don't intervene for our children. This was an excellent opportunity for a child who was missed and misdiagnosed for a couple of years in primary care because she had somaticized or physically manifest her symptoms. The risk that we have when we do not do integrated care is significant. I want to share this story with you as a model. This is informational. We as a CCO are neutral on the bill, but we want to tell you it can be done.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Chair Gelsner and the committee. I'm Kristen Powers. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the manager for health integration up in Central Oregon at St. Charles. And I'm here to kind of just represent our providers at our primary care clinics who fully feel confident and capable to take care of the mentally ill within our primary care practice. And we feel like we're doing that every day. The difference is that we get what's called crumb codes. And it's where they allow us a few case management codes, which is about equivalent to four sessions with a patient, $100. The same sessions at County Mental Health, they can bill around $700. So our sustainability within the primary care isn't really happening. And so I don't want to take up too much time. People told some really great stories, so I think that we could ditto that. But I wanted to let you know that this will really open up an opportunity, and the primary care really supports it.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Silas.
Chair Gelsner and members of the committee, appreciate hearing the stories. And on behalf of Silas Helen Steiner, for the record, president of Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, we support behavioral health care happening in integrated settings, both in primary care and at behavioral health specialty care centers, and representing personal experience and professional experience in YAMHIL community. We have a coordinated care organization called YAMHIL CCO, and we're doing a lot of this work today, much like Trillium's experiencing successes. So this can be done in today's system. We do have questions about, does the bill need to be introduced, and are there a couple of sections that could be revised? At this point, we'd be opposing the mandated fee-for-service reimbursement as opposed to alternative payment models. So we'd like to look at, is there a better way to pay for care in an integrated setting? I know that's a lot of the work that our CCO is doing locally, is looking at a per member per month or some sort of integrated payment that would actually pay for the total cost of care rather than fee-for-service. And then additionally, a question about the $1 million appropriation of state general fund. Is there a way to potentially have that leverage Medicaid match and go into CCO global budgets? I mean, that could be close to $3 million. So some questions around those two parts of the bill. Again, just wanted to say appreciate the spirit of the bill and the intent to open up and create more workforce, and certainly want to be at the table if there are opportunities for amendments.
Well, thank you. And I think the intention certainly is to move this bill. So I'm hoping you can connect with Robin and Senator Montes Anderson to get some agreement on the amendments. And if we can get those drafted, I'd like to be able to get this moving on as soon as we're able.
And you do make a good point. And I think CCOs have a global they have a global budget, and mental health needs to be a part of that global budget, and so they're supposed to be integrated, so clarify that. Great. But they're not, but yes.
Make it happen.
Get it done. Any final words for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all very much. Thank you, everybody. Oh, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 832. And I just want to thank everybody for sticking around. We covered a lot of territory today. The people in this room are all so committed to improving the system. I think we are lucky. People have said it time and again. We're at a new point in Oregon. I think we have the opportunity to do some really great things because of circumstances and all of the people in this room and across the state. So thank you all very much, and thank you, Senator Mondes Anderson, for all the good bills we got to hear today. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing. We're adjourned.
They make more money.
$45.
They make more money.
$45.
I'm going to close the public hearing. We're adjourned.